Well, it's a pleasure to be here. My wife is a Cornell MBA alum, so we were here all weekend, and we had a great time. We actually tracked down the dairy bar. We thought it was at its old location, but we found that it was had moved to Kennedy Hall. So it was great to be back for me, and especially for her. She has tremendously fond memories of Cornell, and I'm beginning to get it, too. Today, as Dean Thomas mentioned, I want to talk really about a couple of different things. One, national and regional economic conditions, and what the Federal Reserve has been doing to try to make things better in terms of getting closer to our dual mandate of full employment and price stability. And I'm also going to focus a bit on housing and conditions here and how this region is a little bit different than the rest of the country with respect to housing. Finally, I have to give you my, before I begin in earnest, my normal disclaimer. What I say today is going to reflect my views and may not necessarily reflect the views of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. So with that disclaimer out of the way, let me start first and talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve itself, who we are, what we are, do, and what we're trying to achieve in the future. The New York Federal Reserve was established in 1913, so we have a centennial coming up in a few years, as part of a broader Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System is unusual among central banks in the sense that it's quite decentralized. There's 12 regional banks spread throughout the United States, with a board of governors that's based in Washington, D.C. The New York Fed District is particularly unusual in terms of its scope. We have New York State, Fairfield County, Connecticut, Northern New Jersey, and then Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands thrown in for good measure. In terms of how the banks are organized, it's actually somewhat interesting that we're not really quite private and we're not really quite public. Each bank has its own charter and its own board of directors. The board of directors actually don't set policy for the banks. Washington, D.C. sets policy. But the board of directors are actually very valuable to us in telling us what's going on in the district and also helping us run the bank in a good way in terms of how we conduct our business practices. The reason why the Federal Reserve was set up this way was really to, by having these 12 different reserve banks spread around the country, it really accomplished a couple different things. One, it meant that the reserve banks, by being in this sort of different format, would be somewhat insulated from political pressure in Washington. And two, by being spread around the country, it would ensure that the central bank would reflect the whole country, not just interest in Washington's or interest, say, in the financial center in New York City. Now, what's the Federal Reserve's mission? Well, Federal Reserve really has several different missions. The one that gets the most attention is monetary policy. By monetary policy, I mean that what the Federal Reserve does in terms of supplying reserves to the banking system to set the level of short-term interest rates in a way that best achieves our goals of full employment and price stability. That's the full employment and price stability is often referred to the Fed's dual mandate. We're supposed to try to achieve both. And the second important role, and this is one that I think was very much underscored by the financial crisis, is the importance of financial stability. We also have an important role regulating the U.S. financial system, overseeing the U.S. financial system. And I think the financial crisis really showed how important that financial stability role was as well, because if you don't have financial stability, you cannot implement monetary policy well or effectively. In terms of the implementation of monetary policy, the Federal Reserve has what's called the Federal Open Market Committee, and the Federal Open Market Committee consists of the 12 Reserve Bank presidents plus the seven Federal Reserve Board governors. Right now there's one vacancy, so there's six governors and 12 presidents, making up now 18 members of the Federal Open Market Committee. And the FOMC meets eight times a year, roughly every 6 weeks, and we're having a meeting next week. And what happens at the FOMC meetings is we basically exchange a lot of economic information about what's going on around the country. So one thing that I will talk to at the FOMC meeting is not just my views of the national economy, but also what's happening in New York State, upstate New York, And we actually have an upstate New York Regional Advisory Board to make sure that we get the information about what's happening upstate. And what I care about what's happening upstate is not just what's happening to economic conditions and employment and inflation, but also get a little bit better understanding about what are the constraints on businesses going forward, what's going well and what's not going well, what are the uncertainties that are going to guide what they do in the future, because it's not just today that matters, it's also what the future, because it's that forecast, how we see the economic outlook evolving, which is going to really drive how we set monetary policy. Now, among the 12 Federal Reserve banks, the New York Federal Reserve is a little different than the other 11 Reserve banks, because we're really the major operational arm of the Federal Reserve System. So if the Board of Governors make the decision about monetary policy, and oftentimes about other matters, it's really the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that makes it so in practice. We implement monetary policy, so when the Federal Reserve decides that they want to move the interest rate, the New York Federal Reserve desk actually engages in the market, adding or draining reserves from the banking system to raise or lower the federal funds rate. We evaluate on a day-by-day basis market conditions. What's happening in markets are very, very important in terms of the transmission of monetary policy to the real economy. So if the stock market's up, bond yields down, financial conditions are easier, and that's going to affect what we do in terms of monetary policy. We oversee in New York some of the major financial institutions in this country. Many more of the major financial institutions reside in New York than any other Federal Reserve District. We operate Fedwire, which is the large dollar payment system between commercial banks. So if you need money today that's treated as real money, cash to the end person that you're paying to, Fedwire can make that happen on a real-time basis. We also provide a lot of important services to the U.S. Treasury. For example, the New York Fed actually conducts the Treasury auctions. So when the Treasury is going out to raise $1 trillion or more of funds each year, it's the Federal Reserve that actually conducts those Treasury auctions on behalf of the Treasury. We also provide a lot of advice to the Treasury about how they might want to do those auctions to raise that money effectively in the future. And then finally, we provide a lot of services to foreign central banks. If you come by the Fed, you can take a tour of our gold vault. In our gold vault, deep into the bowels of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York at 33 Liberty Street, there's, I think it's the largest repository of gold in the world. Unfortunately, it's not our gold, it's foreign central bankers' gold, but we keep it very safe for them, and you can actually take a tour and actually see the gold, and it's just as shiny as you would expect when you see it in person. And then finally, because of all these different roles that we have, we probably have more knowledge about how all the pieces of the financial puzzle fit together than maybe anywhere in the world, and for that reason, the New York Federal Reserve is sought out for advice both by policymakers in Washington, the Board of Governors, the Treasury, and other interested parties, but also internationally, where someone joked to me the other day and said, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is the only bank that has a seat at the table at the Bank for International Settlements. So even though we're a bank, we're treated like we're a country. We're in Basel, Switzerland, where I go. I would guess this year I'll be in Basel at least 8 times. This year. Now, as you might imagine, there's plenty to do with all these responsibilities during normal times, but during the last few years, it's been quite extraordinary what we've been up to. Now, let me talk a little bit about the crisis and our response to the crisis. First of all, I'd say without any qualification, this financial crisis was the worst one that the U.S. has experienced since the Great Depression. And there were really sort of two broad responses to this financial crisis. The first response was that the Federal Reserve had to do a lot of extraordinary things that we had never done before because the financial markets stopped working well because of the severity of this crisis. Banks were unwilling to lend money on to non-bank financial institutions, which caused some not very important non-bank financial institutions to run into significant funding difficulties. The banks themselves became reluctant to deal with one another, so interbank funding costs rose dramatically as we went through the crisis. As a consequence of that, we did some very unusual things during the crisis. First, we developed some broad-based liquidity facilities that we had never put in place before that offered credit not just to the banks, but also went around the banks to the non-bank financial system. And sometimes, too, we actually had to intervene more narrowly in the case of a few large non-bank financial institutions that, if they had failed violently, would really threaten to take down the entire financial system. Of all the things that we did, I think, during the financial crisis, it was those interventions with respect to particular institutions, and I'm thinking of Bear Stearns and AIG in particular, that were the ones that were most uncomfortable from our perspective, because the choice was a Hobson's choice. Either we could let the financial system collapse, let the financial firm collapse, and with it, the financial system, or we could go in and provide aid to keep the institutions afloat, which was very unfair in the sense that oftentimes the financial institutions didn't deserve the support, but it was support that we had to provide because we actually had to focus on the broader goal, which was the national economy and the financial system. The second thing, of course, what we did is in the crisis was obviously we responded by easing monetary policy aggressively. We brought short-term interest rates, the federal funds rate, which we controlled, to nearly to zero in December 2008. And when the tool of lowering the short-term interest rate was exhausted, we went a little bit further than that by committing to keep short-term interest rates low for an extended period of time. And we also enlarged our balance sheet by buying over $1.5 trillion of mortgage-backed securities and treasury securities. We did that because we wanted to make monetary policy still easier, but we couldn't make it easier by lowering short-term interest rates. But by buying these longer-term assets, we could drive down long-term mortgage rates. And by doing that, actually helped support the economy. Driving down the cost of borrowing helped the economy in a number of ways. It helped people refinance their mortgage loans and save money on their financing. It helped reduce the cost of new home purchases. It helped business support their capital spending by driving down their cost of the borrowing. And it helped support household net worth. By buying long-term assets, we pushed down mortgage rates. That helped push up the equity market. And that helped support household net worth, and that was also important in terms of supporting economic activity. So we've done a lot, and so the question is, well, where are we today, and where are we going forward? Well, I think the good news is that the economy is a lot better than it was in 2008 and the beginning of 2009. We do have an economic recovery. The bad news, though, is it's pretty tepid. And the bad news is it looks like the momentum of the economy is slowing. Second half of 2009, the economy grew a little bit over 3% at an annual rate. First half of 2010, it grew about 2.75%. The third quarter data, which we'll get next week, we think will be around 2%. So we're growing, but not very fast. And the problem of growing 2% is it doesn't feel very good because at a 2% annual growth rate, you don't have much in the way of job creation. And for the average person, it's not about what's happening to real GDP growth. Really what's happening is what's that translate to in terms of job creation, in terms of the unemployment rate. And we're not making very much progress there because the unemployment rate remains uncomfortably high at 9.6%. The second consequence is because the unemployment rate's so high, there's lots of slack in the economy. And so there's downward pressure on inflation. Now, a little disinflation isn't a bad thing as long as it's consistent with inflation running around 2%. But the disinflation now has continued onward and onward, and so now we have a situation where inflation is actually running below what we view as consistent with price stability. Core personal consumption expenditures are rising only about 1% now on an annual basis. And that makes us pretty uncomfortable because if the economy is only growing about 2% in real terms and inflation is only rising about 1%, that means that nominal income is growing only very slowly. That makes the economy vulnerable to a shock, and that makes us very uncomfortable in the current situation. So the question, why are we growing so slowly? Well, I think there's a number of reasons for that. Earlier in the economic expansion, things were a little bit more robust because we were getting a big contribution from inventories. During the crisis, in the teeth of the crisis, business activity basically almost stopped. Businesses liquidated inventories very, very sharply, and then when the crisis ended, they started to rebuild those inventories again, and that swing from inventory liquidation to accumulation led to a lot of support to economic activity. But of course, by definition, that swing from inventory liquidation to accumulation can't continue indefinitely. At some point, the inventories are rising fast enough and the businesses don't want to further replenish their inventories. We've now reached that point. The second issue is that the fiscal support that we got in the second half of 2008 and 2009 is starting to fade. We still have support from fiscal policy, it's just not as powerful as it was before. And third, the handoff that we typically get from fiscal policy stimulus and inventory restocking to housing and consumption, that handoff hasn't been accomplished as well as what's happened during past cycles. Housing and consumption are not recovering as quickly as has normally been the case. So if you ask yourself the question, why is housing and consumption so weak, I think it really reflects what happened before the recession. Before the recession, we had a boom, and the boom was fueled by housing, and it was really fueled by underwriting practices that were really pretty poor, frankly. We allowed people to obtain mortgages that really didn't have sufficient income or were of high enough credit quality to actually be able to support those mortgages in normal economic environments. Now, the extension of that credit worked for a while, because when people got those mortgages, they went out and bought homes. That pushed up home prices. And as long as home prices were rising fast, the mortgages looked like they were performing very, very well. The rise in home prices also supported consumption because households felt wealthier, so that created jobs. And so during the boom, things were working, seemed to be going very well. But obviously, the rise in home prices couldn't continue indefinitely. To sustain the rise in home prices, you had to continually relax mortgage underwriting standards. So at some point, home prices were going to start to turn down. And when that happened, all the bad things about the underwriting practices got revealed in spades. People couldn't refinance their mortgages. They didn't have enough income to service their loans. As that happened, losses started to rise on the underlying mortgages. Banks started to pull back in terms of their underwriting practices. They tightened their underwriting practices. That pushed home prices down further. So the whole dynamic that fueled the boom now ran in reverse, leading to a very substantial housing bust. Now, on the consumption side, it's not quite as extreme. But consumption was helped by the housing boom because it made households feel wealthier. And so when home prices fell, households didn't feel as well off. And consumption also now is restrained by the fact that the job market isn't as good. The job losses, the decline in wealth, the uncertainty about the future trajectory of home prices, the tightened credit standards of banks, have all made households feel a little bit more reluctant about opening up their wallets and spending. Households, frankly, are deleveraging in response to the housing bust. So the question is, where are we in that process? Well, I think on the housing side, we're pretty far along in terms of the adjustment process. Housing prices have fallen a lot. Housing is a lot more affordable than it's been in a very long time because prices are down and mortgage rates are down, so housing affordability has gone up a lot. And the rate of home construction activity has fallen a lot. So, it's unlikely that housing construction activity is going to fall very much further because it's already well below the rate of long-term household formation. But we're still not out of the woods on housing for a number of reasons. First, we have a big overhang of supply. There's a tremendous number of home foreclosures in process. Now, the good news is the number of new foreclosures that are started actually is starting to turn down, but it takes a long time between starting a home foreclosure and completing the home foreclosure, and the home foreclosure completions is still going up. We estimate when all the foreclosures are done, we could have an overhang of vacant homes as much as $3 trillion more than usual. So that overhang of inventory on the housing market is going to continue to brisk housing for some time. Second problem we have in housing is obviously lending standards appropriately have been corrected. People are no longer making subprime mortgages, and so that tightening of lending standard means that people who would qualify for a mortgage before won't qualify for a mortgage now. And the third problem is that people who had a lot of equity in their homes, that equity has gone down as home prices has plunged. In fact, as much as 25% of all households in the United States that have mortgages where the mortgage value is higher than the value of the house, so their mortgages are underwater. That's particularly difficult for them because they don't actually have any housing equity anymore, so they're sort of stuck. Their options are to stay in the home or to walk away from the home. They don't have the option, though, of taking their, you know, selling their home and taking their home equity and then buying a new home. Now, in terms of foreclosures, the foreclosures right now are getting quite a bit of attention. In fact, some banks have announced moratoriums on foreclosure. And the issue is that some of the documentation has been flawed. The process has been flawed in terms of how the banks have reviewed the documentation that that's associated with the foreclosure process. Now, the Federal Reserve, really wants to make sure that this is done correctly. So we're reviewing with a couple other government agencies how these foreclosure practices of the mortgage servicers worked to make sure that this is done in an appropriate way going forward. We really do want housing finance to have robust back office operations. You know, we think that this has to be done in a viable way because it's very, very important that buyers have confidence that when they buy, they actually have clear title to the properties that are buying. And this isn't going to be the case if this is done in a sloppy way. It's also important that we do this in an appropriate way because investors who buy mortgage securities in which these mortgages are embedded have to feel that the mortgages are well documented and that the mortgages were underwritten in a way that's consistent with what they thought they were getting when they actually bought those mortgage securities. Now let me turn to economic conditions in upstate New York. I think it's sort of a bad news, good news kind of story. You know, the bad news is the last couple decades where upstate New York has really underperformed. And the story there has been the restructuring of the manufacturing sector in the United States, which has hit upper New York State very, very hard. The population in upstate New York has actually been declining. Job growth has been very weak. And the manufacturing restructuring has caused this region to underperform. But I think there is some good news now. And the good news is that this restructuring process has gone a long way. So this part of the country is much less dependent on manufacturing than they were before. And I think what's happening now is the strengths of the region are very much coming to the fore. And you know, one of the very, very important strengths, I think, is the fact that we have some really, really, really top-flight educational institutions in Upper New York State. You know, we have Cornell here, we have the University of Rochester, Syracuse University, SUNY Buffalo. You know, relative to the population in this region, that's four very world-class educational institutions. And I think that's going to be an important bulwark of this region going forward. Healthcare is also becoming a very, very important part of the economy here. And education and healthcare together, I think, provide a lot less cyclical base of support for this economy. Second good news about this region is that it's a lot less dependent on the housing sector, so it didn't really participate much in the housing boom. Maybe that wasn't a lot of fun during the boom years, but it's sure clearly a lot more fun during the bust years. During the boom years, housing prices didn't go up very much. There wasn't a lot of construction activity because there was no population growth. There was very little subprime mortgage underwriting in this region, so there weren't the kind of sort of dodgy mortgage practices here that you sell elsewhere. And very little construction employment. So when the housing boom turned to bust, the consequences for this region were much less because there were a lot fewer people working in the construction industry to be laid off. This stands in marked contrast to what we refer to as the sand states, Florida, Nevada, California, where construction jobs were a much larger portion of the economy. So great when the boom was taking place, but very bad when the boom turned to bust. So the good news is that the upstate New York is actually outperforming the rest of the national economy over the last couple of years. And Ithaca, in particular, has been really probably the brightest spot, even within upstate New York. Higher education, hugely important in terms of supporting jobs and income, hugely important in raising human capital, building worker skills. And one thing I think is particularly interesting about Cornell is Cornell is really working hard to figure out how it can leverage better all the research that's done at Cornell, a huge amount of research. It's one of the top research universities in the world. How can it take that research and better take that research in partnership with business to make sure that more of that research knowledge gets incorporated in startup company jobs and investment here in Ithaca? And I think that's a hugely, you know, advantageous, strategy going forward. You know, it's not easy. There's huge, agglomeration effects. You know, when you're small, it's very hard to get bigger. Once you're bigger, it's a lot easier to get bigger still because people want to go to the areas where there is that kind of core competency. But I think Cornell has gone far enough now that you can really see the seeds of what could be a very, very successful development path going forward. I would expect that, you know, given my wife's fondness for Ithaca at Vine, I think this particular area is going to do very, very well in the months and years ahead. Now, turning to the Fed, what are we up to? Well, it's pretty clear during the crisis that, you know, we've been very, very active. I described earlier, you know, our active use of monetary policy, both in terms of lowering the federal funds rate to near zero, also in providing important liquidity facilities to help support market function. We've been very active in terms of regulatory policy, both ensuring that institutions do a better job in terms of how they do risk management going forward. Right today, I think it's fair to say that monetary policy is highly accommodative. And to underscore what our intentions are going forward, the Federal Reserve has said at the last FOMC meeting that we plan to keep the federal funds rate at a historically low level for, quote, an extended period, unquote, of time. The reason why I want to do this is that it's not just what the federal funds rate is today that matters, but it's also what the federal funds rate is going to be in the future, because that affects longer-term interest rates and overall financial conditions. The second thing we've done, as I talked a little bit about earlier, is we've expanded our balance sheet. We bought a large amount of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities over the last 2 years, so our balance sheet is much bigger than it was before. We did this to drive down long-term interest rates, to support housing, to keep long-term interest rates low, to support financial assets more generally. And next week, we're going to have to sit down at our meeting to think about whether there are other things that we can do to provide additional support to the economy. The FOMC and the chairman have, quote, have made a commitment to take further actions if necessary to should economic conditions warrant. In a recent speech, I said, quote, current levels of unemployment and inflation and the time frame over which they are unlikely to return to levels consistent with our mandate are unacceptable. And I said that I thought that, quote, further Fed action was likely to be warranted unless the economic outlook were to evolve in a way that made me more confident that we would see better outcomes for both employment and inflation before too long. Now, turning to regulatory policy, I think there's, you know, very, very important lessons of the financial crisis that we have to learn from. The first important lesson is that severe financial disruption leads to very large macroeconomic costs. And those costs in terms of job losses are really, really serious, and we have to take them very, very seriously going forward. This is the primary reason why financial stability is so important to the Fed on a going forward basis, and why it's so important that we implement the new regulatory initiatives that are underway in a way that make the financial system more resilient and robust going forward. What we need going forward is a financial system that can withstand shocks, that can better withstand shocks. We need a financial system where there's not inappropriate incentives to take excessive risks. We need a financial shock where the major financial institutions have enough capital and liquidity, so if there is a shock, they are robust enough that they can continue to maintain their market access. We need an ability to wind down large, complex financial institutions in an orderly way. So the Federal Reserve is never faced with that very difficult Hobson's choice of either saving a large institution from failure because its failure would be catastrophic versus letting the institution, rescuing the institution, and then being accused of trying of creating moral hazard by bailing out larger institutions at the cost of smaller institutions. In terms of the regulatory initiatives underway, I think there's some very important new ones that have made a lot of headway. Internationally, when I go to Basel, I said I went 8 times a year this year. What we've been working on is higher capital and liquidity standards for internationally active banks. And we've done quite well. We've raised the capital requirements for internationally active banks a lot. We've raised the quality of capital that they have to have, so it's a lot more focus on tangible common equity than before. We've allowed a pretty long phase-in period because we don't want this transition to disrupt the economic recovery. But when all the smoke is cleared and 2019 arrives, when these new requirements have to be put in place, you're going to see a large U.S. banks have a lot more robust capital and liquidity on their balance sheet. The second thing we're doing is, of course, we're implementing the Dodd-Frank Act. The Dodd-Frank Act is the act that was passed this summer to reform the U.S. financial system. There's lots of different pieces to the Dodd-Frank Act, but you know, some of the most important one are to realign the incentives for the banking system so people don't take excessive risks. Make sure we have a better resolution regime for non-bank financial institutions to make it so the Federal Reserve is never in this awkward position again. To shine the light on some of the more opaque markets for example, over-the-counter derivatives. So there's more transparency in these markets. So these securities are cleared through central counterparties. So there's much less risk that arise from these markets. The Federal Reserve is going to be very busy, along with the other U.S. regulators, writing the rules for the Dodd-Frank Act over the next 18 to 24 months. Let me say in conclusion, you know, I think that what happens here in New York is very, very important to us. New York Fed has a tremendous number of responsibilities, but the most important responsibility is to stay connected to people in our region that we serve. It's very important that we understand what's going on here so we can carry out our actions responsibly to achieve our dual mandate of full employment and price stability. To do that correctly, we really need to understand what's happening here on the ground. It's important to understand here what the constraints are in terms of the regulatory regime and oversight that we implement. We need to understand how we can do that responsibly in a way that achieves the more robust and resilient financial system that we seek without putting such a high burden on business and banks that actually has negative consequences in terms of credit availability. Current conditions, I think, for the region are pretty good. It was a milder downturn than the country. We are seeing a modest recovery. The region has is pretty far along the transition to a more diversified economy, one that's more knowledge-based with less dependence on cyclically sensitive manufacturing. But we're still not where we want to be, even here, in terms of job creation, in terms of credit availability. I think the road, I think I have to say, is going to be long and bumpy, but we are making progress, and I'm sure that if we stay the course, we will achieve our dual mandate over time. We will get to full employment. We will have price stability. The dynamism that we see here at Ithaca is particularly reassuring. The private sector, the academic research and partnership is really encouraging. The amount of enthusiasm here just for knowledge and learning. I gave a little lecture at one of the classes today. It's always fun for me to do that. I get such a kick out of college students because they're not jaded. They're curious. They want to understand what's going on. They don't carry the kind of baggage that older people like me do carry, so it's always good to see that. So it's really fun to have that opportunity to do that. I really appreciate all of you coming today. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to open it up and take a few questions.
Mr. Dudley, thank you so much for coming to Cornell. About 20 years ago, we did have a Federal Reserve official from New York, Peter Bakstansky, representing Jerry Corrigan, was here too at Cornell. But I want to ask you, you mentioned your trips to Basel a few times in this lecture. And how did you feel as a U.S. citizen and as a Federal Reserve official when you exchanged a U.S. dollar for the CHF and were asked to pay more than $1 for one CHF?
Well, I think that Switzerland's currency has been quite strong, and you know, a lot of that reflects the consequences of what's going on in Europe. As you all know, that Europe has its own set of stresses. Some of the peripheral countries in Europe under significant fiscal strain, and questions about how that will evolve. And as a consequence, the Swiss franc has been a very strong currency, not just about against the U.S. dollar, but also against the euro. Obviously, when I go to Switzerland, I wish my U.S. dollar would go a little further. But my view at the end of the day is, if we do what we need to do in terms of achieving our dual mandate, that's full employment and price stability, the dollar will take care of itself. So I don't spend a lot of time focusing on the dollar. That's really the province of the U.S. Treasury in terms of economic policy. Our province as Federal Reserve officials is to set the monetary policy course and the regulatory course in a way best to achieve our dual mandate.
What are your thoughts on the debt burdens of state and local governments and what it means for the economy as a whole?
The question is, what do I think about the debt burdens on state and local governments? Well, there's no question that state and local governments are under quite a bit of stress. And some of that stress was temporarily abated by the fiscal stimulus package, which actually did give quite a bit of aid to state and local governments. But obviously, that fiscal support was temporary. And so now the state and local governments are continuing to have to wrestle with quite difficult problems in terms of their finances. I think this is going to be, something that's going to be somewhat of a negative for the outlook. I think state and local governments are going to continue to have to tighten their belts because by law they have to run balanced budgets. And that will mean that the state and local government sector will probably not be that robust going forward. Some of this is, the inevitable consequence of the downturn, but some of it's the consequences of some deeper issues. For example, inadequate funding of pension plans, so that the unfunded pension liability for a lot of state and local governments is quite large, and so that's a longer-term issue that the states and local governments have to wrestle with. So I think it's definitely a negative. I don't think it's a big enough negative to derail the economic expansion. I think the risk of a double dip is actually quite low for a number of reasons. Policy is quite accommodative, both at the monetary policy and fiscal level. The cyclically sensitive sectors of the economy that could contribute to a downturn are already very, very depressed, so it's unlikely that they're going to fall much further. The rest of the world is growing quite rapidly, so they're going to tend to pull the U.S. economy along behind it. And finally, the banking system, which was under a tremendous amount of stress a year or two ago, still under stress, but credit availability, credit conditions are actually improving. So that means that even though credit availability isn't quite where we'd like it to be, it's quite a bit better than where it was a year or two ago. So state and local government finances definitely negative for the outlook, but I think the positives outweigh the negatives. So I think we're going to still see continued economic expansion.
Hey, Mr. Dudley, just a quick question. With regards to the mortgage-backed securities that are on the Fed balance sheet, how do you expect to get rid of them, and how much time do you think it's going to take to get rid of them?
Well, we have a large amount of securities on our balance sheet. Our balance sheet today is about $2.3 trillion. If we hadn't engaged in the unusual intervention activity that we did, it would probably be more like $900 billion. And we definitely expect over the long run for our balance sheet to come down. In fact, when people accuse us of our purchases as monetizing the federal debt, I say that's not right at all, because if we were monetizing the federal debt, the increase in the size of our balance sheet would be permanent, and it's not going to be permanent. The increase in our balance sheet is going to persist only as long as it's necessary to have an enlarged balance sheet to achieve our dual mandate of full employment and price stability. Once we are confident that we're going to be able to achieve that dual mandate, we're going to let our balance sheet come down in size. Now, you know, and how we do that, you know, remains to be determined. We have the options of just letting the securities mature over time, or we can actually sell securities into the market. The decision we make will probably be made based on economic conditions at the time. But make no mistake about it, we can manage our balance sheet fine. It's not going to cause a long-term inflation problem over time. We can conduct monetary policy with a balance sheet much bigger than the balance sheet that we have today, if necessary, because we have the ability to pay interest on excess reserves. And that's an important new tool that we got in the fall of 2008. And that ability to pay interest on excess reserves means that we can affect the cost of credit up or down, even with a very enlarged balance sheet. So that's a very, very important tool that people don't put enough weight on, because it means that we can prevent an inflation problem even with an enlarged balance sheet.
Hi. I was wondering, what is your opinion as a general rule about having the Fed target market-based expectations like the spread between regular treasuries and TIPS, or say nominal GDP futures targeting? And in this specific instance, what's your opinion of the more unconventional monetary policy techniques like catch-up inflation or paying zero or even negative interest on excess reserves?
The question is really about things above and beyond what I've talked about today. Like, okay, so like, let's say that we initiate a, you know, we stay with the current program, or we initiate, let's say we initiate a program of further balance sheet enlargement. Are there other things that we could do to support economic activity? Well, if you look at the speech that I gave back in early October, I did talk about some of the other sort of options. And one thing I talked about at considerable length was communications, you know, how we communicate to the markets. A couple different options there. One is more forward commitment in terms of how long we're going to keep the short-term interest rates low. Right now we're saying for an extended period, but maybe we could change that into something that maybe might be even more powerful. Two, I talked about in the speech, the Fed could be more explicit about its inflation a target, you know, that we actually want to see an inflation of around 2% or a bit less going forward. And the advantage of doing that would help anchor inflation expectations and keep inflation expectations from falling. Inflation expectations, you don't want inflation expectations to fall too low, because if they fall too low, that can actually contribute to deflation environment starting to take root. And as we've seen in the case of Japan, deflation can be quite dangerous, especially in a situation where households are deleveraging. And the third thing that we could possibly do is we could commit to a price level target. Now, what's a price level target? Well, a price level target says that we want the price level each year to go up, say, 2% per year. And if in year one inflation is only 1%, that means we have a 1% gap, and we're going to make that up. So we're falling short in year one, so we're going to make up that gap in the future. So we'll accept a little higher inflation for a year or two until we get back to the price level target. Now, you know, these are all possible alternatives for policy. You know, it's all about benefits and costs. Moving to one of these different avenues, would it be helpful or hurtful in terms of costs, benefits that exceed the costs? There are challenges for both an inflation target and for a price level target. For the inflation target, I think the issue is really most people already pretty much know what the Federal Reserve is seeking in terms of inflation, because the FOMC members they publish a long-term inflation forecast, and most of those inflation forecasts are clustered around 1.75% to 2%. So it's not clear that actually saying, here's my inflation target, 1.75% to 2%, really is going to gain you very much. On the price level target, the real problem is communications. It's pretty complicated to explain to people. And if you're below the target, well, how do you go back to the target? Do you want to go back like this? If you go over, how quickly do you come back? So there's a huge number of complications in terms of you know, going from saying, oh, here's the concept, but then how do you actually actualize it and implement it in practice? And so those are things that, you know, we're always thinking about what our other options are. And we're always going to think about, you know, what can we do to actually better achieve our dual mandate? But it's all about, you know, sort of weighing the costs and benefits.
Thanks.
Mr. Dudley? Quick question regarding the Fed's recent decision to buy long-term securities. And my question was, what really made Fed gravitate towards this particular step as against other available alternatives? And what are some of the potential risks of this strategy for the Fed?
Well, in terms of, first of all, we have not made any decisions about expanding our balance sheet. I mean, that's why we're going to have a meeting next week to discuss this and other issues. I think the argument in favor of balance sheet expansion is the fact that it could presumably ease financial conditions further. And the market over the last 6 weeks has gone from an expectation that's very low with respect to further balance sheet expansion to a much higher probability. And as we've gone through that period of time, we've seen that the stock market has gone up and bond yields have come down, and so financial conditions have become more accommodative. So I think that should give one some confidence that if the Fed were to decide to expand its balance sheet, it would probably be supportive to financial market conditions. The cons, the arguments against, are really about, one, exit. Is an enlarged balance sheet going to complicate the Fed's exit from this very stimulative monetary policy? And the second is that the Fed is introducing some interest rate risk into its portfolio because these long-term assets are financed by overnight reserves, and so you have an asset liability mismatch. So the Federal Reserve is going to, carefully sit down to assess the benefits of further balance sheet expansion versus the cost of further balance sheet expansion and try to figure out where's that point where those benefit and cost lines intersect.
Yes, I wanted to ask you if you'd expand on that a little bit. A number of critics of quantitative easing, as it's known, and I guess that means loosely buying longer dated financial assets, say that doing that simply isn't going to stimulate more direct credit creation in the economy because banks aren't lending, or if they aren't lending, that's not going to increase their lending, that it's going to actually only work if it does what you were referring to, creates a kind of wealth effect of its own by buoying the stock market and other assets, and that may be bubble-like in its nature. And secondly, it might work through the mechanism of weakening the dollar, as we've seen people say that quantitative easing is bad for currencies like the U.S. dollar and the British pound. And is that a retreat indirectly to some of the mistaken policies of the Depression era when we all had currency wars and fought to the bottom?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I don't think anybody at the Federal Reserve thinks that balance sheet expansion is a panacea to all the nation's ills. I mean, lots of things need to be done on fiscal front. Lots of things need to be done on reducing policy uncertainty going forward. So there's a whole host of things that need to be happened. So it's not just about monetary policy. But we have a very clear mandate. They don't say anything about, don't use the tool unless the tool is perfect. The dual mandate is that we need to do everything in our power to achieve full employment and price stability. And if there are tools that are available that help move in that direction, then I think that without unacceptably high costs, so we have to weigh the costs against that, then that suggests that we should try to move in that direction. Quantitative easing will, I think, ease financial market conditions. Easier financial market conditions will support economic activity. If we support economic activity and have somewhat more rapid GDP growth, we'll see more job creation. If we see more job creation, we'll see more consumer spending. We'll see an improvement in consumer confidence. So it's not like flicking an on-off switch. It's not the difference between nirvana and, a really, really lousy economic situation. It's really more, it's more operating at the margin. But I think that to the extent that we can do things that improve the economic environment, we certainly, you know, owe it to the millions of people that are unemployed right now to do so.
We'll take the questions of the people that are standing, and then we're going to run out of time.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the question, Mr. Dudley. One of the proposals for improvement of prudential regulation of the banks in the aftermath of the crisis was that for contingent capital. And it's one that the Fed in New York took a leadership position, and you've been associated most prominently with pushing that proposal forward. I wonder if you can comment on the proposal, where it stands right now, and if I can add a wrinkle, what kind of traction the proposal has at the broader level at, for example, the Basel Committee for Bank Stability?
Well, I think that the way I would characterize it is that internationally there's broad, I think there's quite a bit of support for the concept of contingent capital. In fact, the governors and heads of supervision recently issued a communique which basically said that they thought large systemically important institutions needed to have more loss-absorbing capacity, and that loss-absorbing capacity could be met in part by contingent capital or bail-in capital. So there's definitely support for the concept. I think the challenge now is seeing if the concept, you know, which looks good in theory, is good in action, in the sense that markets actually have the capacity to take down large amounts of contingent capital at prices that are attractive to the issuing institutions. So I think the question right now is sort of the feasibility. The attraction for people who don't understand what contingent capital is all about, this is a capital that would basically, it's a debt instrument during normal times, and then it converts into equity right in the middle of crisis. So, right, you know, as the institution is deteriorating in health, the debt instruments convert into equity, and so that actually supports the institution going forward. And the attraction, in theory, of contingent capital is that it would be a lower cost form of capital for businesses, because in most states of the world it would be debt, which tends to be a cheaper form of capital than equity. But I think we're at the phase that the kicking the tires on the theoretical benefits of contingent capital, I think, have been largely complete. Now the question is, can we actually operationalize it? And so that's going to be the challenge going forward.
Thank you.
If housing, the financial industry, increased efficiency from technology and globalization created growth in the past 10 years, what do you think will drive growth and job creation in the next 10?
I think it's going to be, a lot of it's going to be, you know, what happens up here in our noggins. And I think that job creation is really about, you know, especially in a really advanced economy like the U.S., it's about innovation. And last time I looked, the innovation process doesn't seem to be slowing. Go to your cell phone provider and see all the new phones that are every day coming out with new, more, better capability. Or my chief of staff, Mike Schetzel, sitting there with his iPad on his on his lap, which was introduced how many months ago? And sold, I don't know, 10 million copies or something like that already. So I think that it's really about our ability to continue to innovate. And that's why, you know, the educational institutions that we have in the U.S. are a huge competitive advantage of the U.S. When I look at the U.S. relative to the rest of the world, I see two things that are a huge competitive advantage relative to the rest of the world. We have the best higher education system in the world by far. I mean, not even close. And we have probably one of the most entrepreneurial cultures in the world. By, you know, nobody else close. You combine those two things, education and entrepreneurship, you know, that, if done properly, can lead to a lot of innovation. And a lot of innovation means new products, new services that we can sell around the world.
Thank you.
Thanks for speaking today. Oh. So I do think the Fed has done a pretty good job handling the financial crisis. but I am, yeah.
I think I'm probably not the right person to ask that question. I'm going to repeat what I've already said on record. I think there are some things that we could have done better going into the crisis. I think we could have done a better job, in the oversight of some of the large financial institutions. I think we could have done a better job connecting all the dots in terms of all the interlinkages across the financial system. You know, we're not the only one that could have done a better job, but we could have done a better job there. I think during the crisis, though, I think we did awfully well. I really think that the special interventions that we undertook, all the special liquidity facilities, worked. We delivered them on time. They worked as advertised to help improve market function. And when all the smoke was had cleared, we actually generated a profit to the taxpayer. So I think that if you look at actually what happened in the crisis, I think we did pretty well. I think the one area where we could have done better is we didn't communicate as well with people as we should have. We took a little bit of a, you know, passive approach of let actions speak louder than words, and so we'll just let our actions speak for us. And I think at times our failure to explain ourselves led to others to attach more negative interpretations of our actions. And I think that was harmful to the Fed, to our credibility. I think a lot of the accusations were without foundation, but it did have a consequence for us. And I think it's something that we definitely learned our lesson that communication is very, very important.
Thank you very much.